Okay, lesson two. Again, these lessons are all loosely connected around the theme of water. They aren't, how to say this, they're not connected to each other with the exception of the fact that they're all part of the grand plan. And what my friend Bonnie was getting to was that water has often been a part of the plan. God has used this most elemental of physical things in our world to destroy, to create, to give new life, to give hope. All kinds of things have been surrounded around water. And so what we're hoping to do, for those of you who are just starting with us, is to study and find everything we can in these little, quote, Bible stories that we tend to tell the children, and say, what does this mean to us today as Christians? What did it mean in the grand plan? How did it fit in? And how can we apply it many thousands of years later? So, baby Moses, one of my favorite ones to tell the little kids. We've had various times when we went outside and made a felt river and had bulrushes, and they could stand behind them like Miriam and watch the baby. And because it's a really, really interesting story. So interesting that it appears in history in other civilizations. Sargon, king of Agadi, was a Babylonian, said that was him. That he was hid in the bulrushes and he was floated down the river. But I find it hard to believe that his imagination just came up with this story all by himself that fit the biblical account of Moses. So to me, it's just another building block in the all history, all archaeology, all of those things absolutely every time support the Bible. I always told my children, if science didn't support what's in the Bible, it hadn't caught up yet. It's just not there yet. And an interesting side note on that is when I was, one time when I was in school, I had to read this horrible, horrible book. I couldn't stand it. About theory building, and it was by a guy named Kuhn, K-U-H-N. And it was hard, and I was struggling. And the very, very side note on that is my brother and I were talking. He said, oh, here's a book I'm reading you might enjoy. He was reading it for fun, and I was struggling through it. But the only thing I remember about that book was he said, basically, in better language than this, science is right, always, until it's wrong. And he said, and you look through history, and it's always right. Here's the number of stars in the sky. Oh, wait, now we have a telescope. No, we don't know how many stars are in the sky, and what did the Lord tell us? We can't count them. And so I thought, as a scientist who appeared to have no scriptural, no religious leanings at all, but he was very, very clear about it. Yeah, it's right. Well, it's not. So you have to take everything with a grain of salt and look at it in the larger picture. So, side note, now we'll come back to baby Moses. Remember that at this point in history, God had delivered the people to Egypt. It didn't feel like deliverance, really, at the beginning. I mean, Joseph didn't feel like he had been delivered to Egypt, I don't think, except like a package. But his being there did what?
For the plan and center.
Yeah. When Joseph was there, what was the ultimate outcome of that?
They saved people.
They came there. They grew. They prospered. Well, eventually, Joseph died. New king came along. And they have prospered, the people, the Hebrew people, so much that there's a ton of them. And Pharaoh's a little nervous about this. Why is he nervous?
Because there's more of them. And he's afraid they're going to overtake.
There's starting to be more of them. He and his people may wind up becoming the minority. It doesn't sound like they're there yet, but he's seeing what's going on. So he said, what are we going to do about this? So what did he decide to do? At the very beginning.
Enslave them.
Enslave them. Okay. So he did, and what happened? More people, happier, healthier people. So then what did he decide? Not quite yet, though.
Make it worse.
Will they? You remember how you had to build the bricks? Okay, now you got to get your own stuff to build the bricks. And the first box says build with rigor. Mm-hmm. So taskmasters were set over them to make sure they were rigorously building. And I found a couple of interesting historical books. I was actually going to scan some of this and get it to you. My computer ran out of ink, so it was 11 o'clock at night. I wasn't going to go get any. But building for the Pharaoh, you can see this hieroglyph here about how they had to find the dirt and make the mud and add the straw, and then they've got to bake it and then they've got to move it to where it goes. I can't imagine it being a happy day's work, you know? Part of this I want to read. Why have you not fulfilled your quota of bricks? In Exodus 5:14, it says, this relief from the tune of a vizier illustrates how bricks were manufactured. The workers first collected mud left over in pools after the Nile flooded over and carried to jars into the brickyard. It was kneaded with a small hoe. Straw was added, shaped into bricks. In the relief, one workman tightens the blade of his mattock. It's here by pressing against the stack of dry bricks. Anyway, lots of hard work involved in this. And just so we kind of remember how much work they were doing, remember that the Egyptians built things like these. These weren't little go build my house kind of projects. Lots and lots of work. So, well, that didn't work out for anybody well either, because what happened with people, with the Hebrew people?
They thrived.
They thrived again. So now he's pretty frustrated because it, let's go, we've missed a couple of questions. Let's go back up to question one. What happened to the Egyptians, I'm sorry, what happened to make the Egyptians forget about what Joseph had done?
They had a new king.
No Joseph. And time had passed. And unfortunately, if you look at Christianity, if you just look in our own lives, how often is the third generation of a family a faithful family? It takes very little time for us to forget. Historically, World War I was the war to end all wars. How many years later before we had World War II?
18, 20.
Not many. So we don't, and they always say, if you don't know history, then you're doomed to repeat it. I wonder if we're not doomed to repeat it, maybe. Anyway, we don't remember very well. So he didn't remember that Joseph had not just saved his own people, Joseph had saved the Egyptian people. If they hadn't stored that food up, the famine covered the land, what would have happened to the Egyptian people?
They would have all died.
But he didn't remember any of that. He just saw all these Hebrews. So why did he set the taskmasters over? Well, Exodus 1:10 says, lest they multiply. And in case they multiply, in case we go to war, in case they join our enemies, and in case they overwhelm us.
A lot of ifs.
I mean, at that point in time, as far as I can tell, the Hebrews were no threat to the Egyptian people. We have nothing recorded that tells us they were becoming militant, that they were uprising. He just said, there might be too many of them, we might go to war, they might join our enemies, and they might win. It's a little paranoid, I think. But I think it was very interesting and paradoxical that he was saying, we're going to do this so they won't turn against us. But what did doing all of this make happen?
The flourishing war.
But it didn't endear the Egyptians to the Hebrew people, did it? I mean, it didn't make them go, oh boy, we're so glad we live here. You know, so he's trying to avoid having an enemy uprising or an uprising from within, and is actually creating a situation that would probably lead to that uprising. Politicians have never been the most amazing brainiacs, even from back then. Exodus 1:1. I have some notes from Barnes notes that I want to, there's a few of them I want to talk about. The taskmasters. These were the, according to Barnes, these were the Egyptian chiefs of tribute. They were men of rank, superintendents of public works. They weren't just a guy on the street. You know, they were political people. They were, the Israelites were employed, of course, in forced labor now, but weren't completely enslaved. They still had their own homes and ran their own lives. They just had this forced labor. And it says that they built the cities of storage, places where they were Pithom and Ramses. Again, according to Barnes, they were both cities situated on a canal which was dug or enlarged during the 12th dynasty. The name Pithom means house or temple of Tum, the sun god, and the name Ramses is generally assumed to have been derived from Ramses II, who we think may have been the pharaoh during this time. Okay. Pharaoh was to make their lives even in number three. Oppressed people often languish. Why is that? Oppressed people often don't make it very well. Why not?
They're kind of beaten down.
They lose hope.
They lose hope. They lose the ability to work hard. I mean, because why should they? You know, they're not getting anything from that for themselves. But just the opposite happened. They just, yes, ma'am.
What? This came across my head as I was studying this. Why did they accept this bondage to begin with?
Okay, good question. Why did they accept this bondage?
I mean, they seem to have just said, well, okay, that's what you want to do, that's what we'll do.
Okay. Amy?
My assumption has been because they knew they were foreigners in this land, that they had been privileged to live there the way that they had while Joseph was alive.
They saw themselves as a different people. Mm-hmm. They didn't assimilate and become Egyptians. Mm-hmm. They stayed Hebrews. I think that's an excellent point. I think God had a hand also. But I think another thing is that people are very reluctant to make changes. Why did Germany just let Hitler do what he did? Because he created a lot of atrocities before he ever got to trying to extinguish the Jews.
Well, of course, he kept them from organizing. And you have to, if you are going against an organization, you have to be organized
also. Right. And I doubt the Egyptians by this point, again, we're just speculating, but I doubt the Egyptians by this point looked at the Hebrews and said, oh, they're our friends and neighbors. Because if Pharaoh felt this way, you can guarantee that was filtering down.
Sure.
So they were probably oppressed in a lot of ways before the actual bondage work came in. I mean, I think that probably didn't happen and he woke up one morning and said, enslave them. And that was the first thing that ever happened. Again, we don't really know, but a good thing to think about. Why didn't they rise up? Well,
it probably happened over a slow period of time. Right. Not just like you said, one morning wake up and decide to do it.
Probably lost liberty a piece at a time.
Well, didn't
don't
they have
get me started.
Someone overseeing the work too? I mean, they had people watching.
Oh, they had taskmasters.
Yeah.
At that point, there would have been no way to say, I'm sorry, I'm not doing that today. I don't feel well. I think I'll stay home. That wasn't going to happen at that point. But prior to that point, I believe it had to have been a gradual process. And finally, he said, you know, this is getting out of hand. Too many of them. We've got to take care of this. Thinking that as enslaved people, they die off.
Well,
because that's what generally
Joseph,
happens.
And so it turned from the love of the people to the other direction.
Right.
But very slowly, evidently.
Over time. Over time. One place. So number four, Pharaoh was desperate to reduce the number of the Hebrews. His first two plans about, okay, they're going to work hard. Now we're going to work harder, set taskmasters over them. So I didn't really, maybe I lost one in here somewhere, but number four and number five were, I think, were the same answer. What did he finally decide to do? How was he finally going
to
get rid of them?
Told the midwives to the sons that were born, save the daughters.
Kill all the baby boys.
And number five is the same, except at that point, because the midwives who feared Gadi told all the people.
Well, yes, that, you're right. That is the different point. The midwives just didn't do it. And there's some historical comment that these midwives perhaps are even Egyptian midwives, that they were not all Hebrews. And even the Egyptian midwives were saying, I'm not doing that. And they also said, what did they say about the women?
That they're stronger.
they had healthy babies. They didn't need me. I didn't get there in time. Couldn't have killed the baby because I wasn't there. Another historical note that I read said probably they were healthier and more able to bear children. They're out working. We know that the Egyptian women generally were kind of secluded and didn't do much, the wealthy ones, didn't do work, very much work. So, you know, it's nothing new under the sun. What's your doctor going to tell you when you have a problem? Diet and exercise. You don't have to go to medical school. They have to say diet and exercise. Laura?
I was just going to say, it did say that the midwives feared, well, they were Hebrew, but they feared God. God dealt well with them because of that.
Right, which took a lot of courage. I mean, there's nothing in history that makes me think pharaohs were kind, generous, empathetic people. You know, they were just done what they said, and that was the end of it.
Jean?
Yes, ma'am.
The scripture said that God built them the midwives' houses. I can't think where it was in something I read. Okay. So he had to have had a hand in it.
Oh yeah, he was protecting them. But Barnes' note on Exodus 1:15 says, when it says Hebrew wives, it may be midwives. It may mean midwives of the Hebrew women, because these two names here in 15, Sipra and Pua, Barnes says were Egyptian names. So whether Barnes knows that or not, I don't know, but that's what he says. He says they were Egyptian names, and therefore probably Egyptian women who served as midwives for the Hebrew women, who still feared God. Mm-hmm. They knew. And, you know, again, you can get way off into speculation, but can't you just imagine if these were Egyptian women and they're helping the Hebrew women? The Hebrew women are talking about God. Mm-hmm. And their faith,
example,
what they do, and they're leading examples. And
well, even later when the plagues came upon Egypt and Pharaoh was being stubborn, his own magicians, who had originally been part of the I can do it just as well as you
right.
can, now begged him yeah. to fear God and yeah. stop
this. There's more going on here.
Egypt
yeah.
has been destroyed. Stop this, you
yeah.
know. And yet Pharaoh was still stubborn.
And had the power to destroy his own people by not following God.
So some of the Egyptians, my point
right.
is, you know, could see that God right. was behind this.
Right. Bonnie talks here about genocide being used throughout history to win wars. I mean, it's not a new concept anywhere. Who did Hitler, who was he responsible for?
Jews.
On that list, the Jews. And the number 6 million is there, but I've heard higher numbers. Then I've heard the people who say it didn't happen. That bothers me. The Hutus.
I've heard that that's not all. That wasn't all Jews either.
Oh no! I mean, he wanted to call off the Gypsies too.
Yeah.
And Romanians, they were
6 million may not be all Jews.
Right.
Right.
And it may be more than 6 million.
Right.
Once you start getting to those kinds of numbers, you can't know. Because nobody's taking a list. Nobody's walking around at these thousands of bodies and checking off a list.
Well, he also didn't warrant no one.
Right.
But he was killing them.
He was a crazy man, but he's a pretty smart crazy man.
They burned a lot of what could have been substantiated.
Right, right.
A lot of the documents.
Yeah. The Hutus over Rwanda, who did they kill? Tutsis. Mm-hmm. 800,000, my research last night was saying could have been as much as a million, million and a half. Saddam.
Iraqi Kurds.
The Iraqi Kurds. again, you can't know numbers once you get into hundreds of thousands of people. And then,
I don't think anybody likes the Kurds. I feel sorry for that. Turkey doesn't like them.
Nobody wants them. Throughout history, they've been pretty down. And then Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. So Pharaoh didn't invent the idea, but he wasn't the last one to use it either. Mm-hmm. It'll just sack and burn and get rid of everybody that might have an uprising.
Gee, I was going to say, you know, in studying all those, when you were, when Opal asked, like, why did they just let them? These people are very oppressed, and then you have this person come in, and these crazy people come in, and they just, they just make that bad situation much worse.
If you read the history, not just biblical history, but just secular history, very few dictators come in and kill everybody. That's not how it happens. They come in, they gradually take away liberties, they gradually oppress, they gradually control. And then when it gets to the point of slaughter, I mean, a lot of the German people were convinced they had to get rid of Jewish people. By the time that happened, they were true believers. And we find ourselves thinking, how could that be? How could you ever believe it was okay to slaughter a group of people? But there's enough history to tell us that people believe it, and they do it. And it won't be the last time it happens. If the Lord lets the world continue, that kind of thing will happen again.
It's like apostasy. It's just very slow and gradual, and people get to the point to where they just bring them out, I guess. You know, it happens so slowly, and they just can't see what's happening. They don't want to see.
Yep, don't want to see. That's a big part of it, too. Okay, next page. Unless I've left out something on page one there. A Hebrew woman had a baby boy who was described as beautiful. Okay. Every mother thinks her baby's beautiful. But what, and I have a couple of comments on that, but what made this mother protect her baby from being discovered? And how can you hide a baby? All right, there's a lot of answers in all that. Was he beautiful?
Yeah. I think his spirit was beautiful. I mean, in that way. Because every baby is beautiful in the eye of the mother.
Of the eyes of the mother. Barnes says that he was called a goodly child. Probably Jochebed didn't call in a midwife, and she was, of course, cautious. So the Bible acknowledges him as a goodly child, but whatever that means. But of course he was beautiful to his mom. How do you hide a baby? Because, you know, he didn't go in the river until he was 3 months old. So how do you hide a baby?
Did she hide the baby or the fact that the baby was male?
Good point. We don't know.
Oh, that's clever.
Well,
he was a good baby, and he probably just ate and slept. I mean, some babies just don't cry very much.
Right, right. So maybe there was a pretense that it was a girl.
Well, Hebrews said that they feared God and had mortal fear. And so they believed God, and they knew it was wrong.
That's what made her protect her baby.
And made her protect it until he got old enough that she couldn't hide him.
It was faith. Hebrews tells us that by faith, they hid the baby, they put him in the bulrushes, and they feared not Pharaoh. So I think that tremendous amount of courage there, because I'm not thinking Pharaoh would take it lightly. I told you to kill him, you didn't kill him, well, you're next. Mm-hmm. You know, and she has two other kids to think about, because we know that Aaron and Miriam were already there.
They were probably older before this was enacted.
Probably born, yeah, before it was enacted, because Aaron's 3 years older than Moses. We know that later on, when Aaron was 73. And Moses was 3 score.
Originally, I was thinking that she wouldn't have been able to hide the fact that she had a baby because people would have seen her expecting. But I just realized if they were used to the babies being killed, they would have thought nothing of her walking around.
Of her being pregnant.
Right.
Yeah, it wasn't the pregnancy.
Right. So it is possible that she was just able to hide the fact that she had a baby at all for 3 months.
Yeah.
But his cries started getting stronger. And
he's awake more and all those things that happen around 3 months.
Be more mobile.
Yeah. So
think of the burden that would have been if she's out doing manual labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, the dress back then probably before.
Well, that's true.
They may not even know.
Yeah. But even if they did, the other Hebrew people aren't going to turn her in.
Right.
No.
But the other women were also becoming expecting and then
losing their babies.
Their babies because they were
so
being
maybe
killed,
so. You know, there could be crazy people that said, if my baby died, so's yours.
Well, I didn't mean that so much as
but
I do
true,
that,
though.
That nobody might question her walking around not pregnant anymore and saying, where's your baby?
Right.
They might have just
assumed that the baby was
like
killed.
They were.
Did you see God's providence in all?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In when we go back to where it's talking about the goodly child, this is Baker's. No, Adam Clark's commentary on the Bible. And he says that the text simply says he was good, a goodly child, which signifies, according to this guy, that he was perfect, well-formed child, but and as well as beautiful. Stephen, he says, but he doesn't give me a scripture, and I forgot to look it up, so interprets this, he was comely to God, or divinely beautiful. Which is really more what I think anyway. I think that God knew that this was the child who was going to grow to be the man who could lead the people. Since he knows us before we are. Okay, number 8. From one ark to another. Remember we talked about the word ark was only used twice in the Bible for Noah's and Moses. What was this one made of?
Peppers?
Bulrushes?
Peppers, bulrushes. Pepper with what?
Pitch
and tar.
What's the vitamin? I thought pitch was tar.
It is.
What's the vitamin?
Same thing.
Oh, okay.
It's that same sticky substance that would waterproof something.
Well, I read somewhere that pine trees have you can cut one, and that liquid is like pitch.
Well, I would believe that pine resin hardens.
You know, hardens,
it's sticky and it hardens.
You can't get it off of you if you get it on.
Certainly can't get it off something you dropped it on in your house. Some other notes here from Clark. A small boat or basket made of the Egyptian reed called papyrus. I gave you a little handout about papyrus. It grows on the banks of the Nile and in marshy grounds. It rises to a height of 6 or 7 cubits. So, 9 or 10 feet, as we call
it. I have heard people call the plant we have here, I didn't see it up north, but I've heard them call it papyrus. That's why when I was reading this, it's that one with the... I've heard people call it papyrus.
Really?
But when I was looking at this picture, and it's similar, but not quite the same.
Yeah, and that doesn't grow by water.
Yeah.
Particularly. I mean,
it's
out.
We don't have a whole lot of that.
No, it's out everywhere. It says, this reed was of the greatest use to the inhabitants of Egypt, the pith contained in the stalk, serving them for food, and the woody part to build vessels. And the vessels pictures appear frequently on engraved stones and other monuments. I think it's interesting that we kind of forget that it says his mother, what was her name? Moses' mother?
Jochebed.
Put the ark in the bulrushes. We tend to have that picture. She's setting him down in the river. Well, what does a river do?
Flows.
It flows. And she set Miriam to watch over him. So she had to put him where he wasn't going to go. So she put him up in the edges, in the bulrushes, where the little ark would float, but wouldn't go anywhere. And it says, how big do you think it was? Well,
she didn't have a lot of time. I wouldn't imagine she made it huge.
And why would she?
Yeah, you wouldn't want it to be too big.
Yeah, you don't want it to be huge so that a soldier's going to see it somewhere. And you just need it big enough to put the baby in. You know, they still make those wicker ones they call Moses baskets for babies that are about that long. So I thought there's no way to know how big it was. My assumption is she's going to make it quickly, and she's only going to make it as big as she needs to make it for the baby.
And a funny side note, when the Scroggins kids were all small, Thaddeus was a baby. The four older ones were all playing baby Moses one weekend when I was down there. And they were putting him in the laundry basket.
Baby Moses.
Where was his dad when all this was being done?
Baby Moses' dad?
Yeah.
Probably working for Pharaoh, don't you think?
I would think so. Just on the
list. Yeah, we never hear about
she made the
we never hear about Amram. I don't know, probably the men didn't know how to make those baskets. That's I mean in history that's been mostly women's work. So then here's this little boat, this little ark with a baby in it. Who finds it?
Aristotle.
And what how'd she get it back? Did she go plonk down in the middle of water?
That one of her attendants.
Center maid. I've had several references. This one is Erdman. But several of them talk about how it might have been Pharaoh's daughter by a concubine as opposed to being by his wife. No way to know that. We just know she was his daughter. But the reason they say that is because it was unlikely that a royal, truly through the lineage, would be down at the river washing, that they would have water brought to them. So it's just a supposition, but it makes a little sense to me. Nevertheless, she was his daughter. But when it talks about it, it says, and this made sense after I thought about it, it wasn't so unusual for maybe even a child of foreign birth to be brought back, to be brought up by the women, because Egypt was a pretty cosmopolitan place. There were lots of different races and ethnicities in this great port of Egypt. So it says that it was not uncommon. Now, again, that's what this guy's telling me. I don't know that to be true. But it would make sense in that Pharaoh let the baby be brought back. And as long as, I can almost hear him saying, okay, as long as you're going to bring him up as an Egyptian, because then he's not a threat to us. Little did he know. But, you know, that would be the thinking. He's an Egyptian, so that's okay. He's not a Hebrew. But we also know that she said she needed a nurse. Remember, Moses is 3 months old here. How do they eat when they're 3 months old? They have to have milk. And she doesn't have milk. She's not a mom. So Miriam pops out and says, what?
Would you like me to find a woman among the Hebrews?
Yeah, you can find somebody. I can get somebody for you. And she said yes. So Moses went back home, lived with his mother. And somewhere in here, it asks, or I thought, or maybe I made this up, how long he stayed there, stayed at home.
What did?
Well,
obviously
3 years.
Until he was done. I put until he was done.
Until he was weaned.
It
doesn't tell us.
I don't think it tells us, but he has to have been able to eat food.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the reason his mom was taking care of him. Okay, we should back up. We skip down.
You see, the same thing was done with Samuel.
Mm-hmm. But he was home a lot longer.
Yeah, but he stayed there until he was old enough.
Right, to go serve.
Mm-hmm.
When Pharaoh's daughter had compassion on the baby, she broke, I'm on number 12, I'm sorry. She broke Pharaoh's command. What did the baby need and how is that supplied? We talked about that. I keep putting my books down and remembering I want to read something. She had compassion on him. The sight of a beautiful babe in distress could not fail to make the impression here mentioned. It had already been conjectured that the cruel edict of the Egyptian king didn't continue for long. It appears to have just kind of been a blip, and he figured out it wasn't working. But we're not told how long the edict stayed in place. It would not appear unreasonable, again, lots of supposition here, to suppose that the circumstances related here might have brought about its abolition. I think that's a stretch. I think she goes home and says, I found a Hebrew baby, I want to keep him. And he says, okay, we're not going to kill any more Hebrew babies. Yeah, I can't find anything that makes me think that's how that worked. Could have, we don't know. But it says she probably implored her father to get rid of this horrible edict, and this baby would have died, and see how precious it is. There's just a whole lot of human thinking going on, which could have happened, but I can't find anything that makes me think that's how it happened. Laura?
Did they definitely know that he was a Hebrew baby?
Well, Miriam said, shall I go find one of the Hebrew women?
Right.
That's what makes me think that they knew. It doesn't say she knew for sure, but let's think about it. She finds a baby floating in the river.
Right.
Is it going to be an Egyptian baby? Why would it be?
Verse 6 of chapter 2.
Says what?
Read it for me, please. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrew children.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. And maybe from looks, I mean, different ethnicities have different looks, or maybe she just figured out he's floating in the river, and somebody's trying to keep him from being killed. And then Miriam said, shall I go find a Hebrew woman to care for him? So, yes, thank you. The baby was named Moses by the woman who rescued him. What does that mean?
Because I drew him out of the water.
So I drew him out of the water to be drawn out. So how did water play a part in saving this baby? And who else was eventually saved through these actions? First of all, how did water play a part?
He was set in the water. He was set apart.
Set apart.
I don't know what she's looking for, but I came up with the children of Israel.
Right. The entire Israelite nation
was saved.
Because Moses was saved. Mm-hmm. Because God had that plan. And we're not told, but probably. I can't say probably. That implies I know something. Possibly. It was God who told Jochebed, put him in the water. Save him this way. We don't know. But the entire Israelite nation was brought out of Egypt because this baby was saved.
Looking back, we can come to certain conclusions, but at that time, you know.
Right.
You didn't know that.
Right. And this question's kind of out of sync, but how long was it before the baby went to live in Pharaoh's household? He had to at least have been weaned. He had to be eating food. So that's somewhere around age one.
I was going to say, the little tea leaf, it's like they do this long study of nursing. But I read through them that they say that children were a lot older. Like now we wean them at one or whatever. They were a lot older before they were weaned.
Well, because in much of the ancient world, food supplies were pretty dicey. You know, you couldn't just afford to say, okay, no more nursing because we got plenty of food now. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the floods didn't do what you wanted them to do and you don't have any grain, so that doesn't surprise me to think that babies were nursed for much longer.
Well, just a lot of times they were nursed from one baby to the next.
Yeah. That's true.
Sometimes that was quick.
And then we talked about this a little bit. Why do you think it was possible for this Hebrew child to live in Pharaoh's household? Laura says she's got nothing.
Well, it's the only thing I can see is it's by God.
God's intervention.
And
while it may have been a cultural thing that allowed it, or she may have hidden him. I mean, Pharaoh had a lot of wives. She could easily have just had him. And
she could have been even easier than Moses' mother.
Really. That's right. So.
Well, she had also got Pharaoh to release his command on killing the children, so.
You know, Sharon, I couldn't find that, so where is it for me?
It was in her question up here.
Yes, but it was speculative. Where's the verse?
Oh, that I don't know, but.
Yeah,
it was well known that he was in the household.
Well, it was well known when he was older, but not when he was a baby, that I can find. Because it says he was trained up in all the education, you know, of Pharaoh's household. But still, if she had him there and hiding him, I'm not thinking Pharaoh went to the house of the women every day and said, who's this kid? You know?
That probably was sent for a woman. And that was it.
Likely. So I'm not
favored by Pharaoh, maybe. We don't know.
We don't know, but I'm not convinced that Pharaoh knew that a Hebrew child was being brought up in his household.
Well, a lot of times someone's character is how we can figure something out. If we're going to speculate, it's kind of like, you know, when someone's guilty or innocent,
right,
their character proves who they are and what,
right,
they did. My assumption would be that Pharaoh never softened. You know, if you look at all that,
when you see what happens later,
to suffer, and
yeah,
he never repented, tells me that he was a very hard man. And you know, it would, there's no proof of this, but it would make more sense that he was hidden even there than that.
That's what makes more sense to me, because my thinking was that this one child and one daughter who said, "Oh, please don't kill the babies." Like you said, we have no evidence that he became a nicer person. When they wanted to leave, and was that this Pharaoh or was that his son? But whoever it was, there's no indication that the Hebrew people were in any better shape later on. So, I agree with you.
I think if he had ever repented, God would never have taken the action on him that he did. It was
and
a necessary action because of his rebellion.
So, to me, it's likely that Moses just grew up there and Pharaoh did not think about it. Again, speculation, we don't know.
That's paragraph kind of answers all that, too.
Sometimes even when the circumstances seem insurmountable, God's plans are manifested in awesome ways. Baby that wasn't supposed to live, and in fact had been condemned to death, came to live in the home of the man who'd ordered his death. God indeed works in mysterious ways as wonders to perform. Okay, so we have two questions we always want to finish up with. How does this story fit in with the entire plan?
Well, we know who's in control.
We know who's in control.
And he was saved by the water.
He was saved by the water. What would have happened had the Israelites not come out of Egypt and moved to the Promised Land? What? And not become the people of God. And not, you know, it's part of the story that gets us to Christ. And I think that's the part we always have to remember. Baby Moses being pulled out of the water helped in the plan for Christ to come for us. It's all part of the plan, and God foreknew it. So, what can Christians learn from, specifically from Amram and Jochebed?
Faith.
Faith.
Even in insurmountable situations.
A lot of hope along with that faith.
Well, faith in the face of fear.
Courage. Courage.
Because, you know, it took a lot of courage to do that because they would have been punished.
Oh, absolutely. They'd probably been killed. Probably the whole family.
The whole family, yeah.
They would have seen no reason to leave two kids alive. Perseverance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole time she had Moses, she's teaching. She's trying to get things in. He's little, but she's trying to... we know that he always viewed himself as a Hebrew. Now, how that managed to stay over the years, I don't know, but...
See, he had to be with his mother long enough for her to teach him.
She had to do a lot of drilling in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure...
We also learned that civil disobedience is allowed if what? If the law of the land, what? Does God say murder your babies? They could not murder their child or allow their child to be killed and be obedient to God's law. Because of that, they broke the law of the land. And we know that they didn't, that the Israelites did not particularly break the law of the land as they went on. They allowed themselves to be in servitude, and there were a whole lot more of them. They could have risen up, but they didn't. And one more thing we can learn as Christians, the sacrifice that's necessary. They gave up their son so that they could save him. I doubt very seriously that she was happy on the day she had to turn him over to Pharaoh's daughter, because he's little. I don't know how old he is, but he's not a grown man. But her sacrifice allowed his being allowed to live. So there are a lot of things that we can learn as Christians from this lesson.
I wonder a lot how much he learned about his people if he lived in the household of the Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
he must have learned quite a bit from somebody.
He had to have, because he identified himself as Hebrew.
Yeah, I would go out and see my brethren. I don't know who needed that for me. Mm-hmm.
So somehow in that, even though he was receiving the education, he failed. Right, we're out of time. Questions? Comments?
I was going to say, you hear people talk now about, oh, we're in the last days or whatever. You have to think about our situation and their situation. Reminds us who's in control, and we don't know when Christ comes.